As endangered species go, surveys show that tigers and elephants are among the most popular. They're the species the average person might be most willing to donate money to save. But as approximately 20,000 species of plants and animals inch toward extinction, which ones are being overshadowed? And is it for the right reasons? We explore these questions and more this hour. Good morning, I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:07 on Monday, January 6th. What factors should be considered when it comes to species conservation? What criteria should we set? We ask that question of you this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Christine Delamore, editor for NationalGeographic.com, and she edited all the articles in National Geographic's Last of the Last series. She's the author of the recent article, 20,000 Species Are Near Extinction. Is it time to rethink how we decide which to save? Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, you write that 20,000 species are at the risk of extinction at this time. What does that look like as if we were to draw a pie chart of all the species on planet Earth?
Well, actually, it's probably a lot of the ones that you've never heard of, you know, the insects, the little invertebrates, most of the guys that you wouldn't consider necessarily cute. So you're not going to see a panda species or a tiger or something like that going extinct every day.
So what are we seeing?
Maybe an ant or sometimes something like a frog because they've been hit by a horrible fungus that's going around the planet, sometimes a turtle. But a lot of these go extinct, you know, sort of silently without a lot of media coverage, so you might not know about their plight normally.
How well on the radar are they of scientists, or are there species going extinct that we're not even aware of in the first place?
That's actually very true, and that's why a lot of scientists are trying to, you know, do a global inventory of species and try to figure out how many we have so we know how many we have before they go extinct. There are millions of species on the planet likely that we don't even know about yet.
So what's leading to this? Why are so many species on the brink of extinction?
There's a variety of factors. A lot of the ones that I discussed in my series is due to habitat destruction. So you talk about the American burying beetle, for example. This I guess you'd call it cute little beetle that lives in different parts of North America. It's losing its habitat, you know, due to farming, agriculture, development, that kind of thing. So that's a common reason. Another one is poaching, you know, killing the animal for various reasons. And then also things like shifting temperatures or changing climates can also influence extinction.
Would you say that one is more prominent, the other, human influence versus matters that are beyond our control?
It depends where you are in the planet. You know, certain areas, say like Indonesia, it's one of the places that's being forested most quickly in the world. That probably has more habitat destruction element. So, you know, it depends on where you're looking.
Christine, I'm going to put you on hold for a moment so we can reestablish a phone connection with you, and you're just cutting up just a bit. We're talking with Christine Delamore. She's editor for NationalGeographic.com. She edited a series of articles under the National Geographic's umbrella, the Last of the Last series, and we're discussing how endangered species make it onto the protected list. How do they get protected status? We'll find out later how the criteria are set, and some of them are not necessarily scientifically objective. So we'll learn why that is and what the consequences are of that. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. If you're on Twitter, you can find us at Joy Cardine Show. Let us know what endangered species you're concerned about the most. Which ones have you paid most attention to, and have you considered why? Have you considered why certain species play more prominently in your mind when you think of endangered species? Are you picturing the panda? Are you picturing elephants? Or are you picturing some of the lesser knowns, an ant or a spider or a salamander? That's one of the issues that our guest this hour brings up, is what favors prominently in the minds of the public as we consider protecting endangered species. You can also weigh in with your opinion as to what criteria should be set for allocating resources toward conservation and other methods for trying to save endangered species. Once again, our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. And Christine, we've got you back here. If you could just repeat for us what you were saying earlier when we lost connection with you.
I was talking about the causes of extinction.
That's right.
Is that correct? Yeah, so it depends on where you are. If you're somewhere like Indonesia, where there's like very high rates of deforestation, that kind of habitat loss is a huge factor. But if you're somewhere like the Arctic, where we're losing ice very quickly, then something like the changing climate weighs more heavily.
In the grand scheme of, I guess, natural history, do we know whether the rate of extinction we're seeing now is worse than usual? Is it unnatural in a way?
That's actually a debate among scientists about whether what they call the background rate of extinction is increasing. Some scientists believe it's, you know, thousands of times greater. Others believe it's much less. But I think that most agree that you know, there are dozens of species going extinct every day, and that there are influences that we're having to the natural world that are increasing the rate. It's just a debate as to how much.
At the same time, I hear news stories once in a while reporting that new species are discovered every day. Is that true? And if so, does it even out, I guess, what's going on with extinction?
I don't believe so. There are millions of species on the planet. And even if we're finding new ones, I think the rate at which the other species are going extinct is much greater. So, you know, it's hard to balance out, but I believe that the species that are going extinct are greater than the ones that we're discovering.
Tell us a little bit about what animals we're losing and what part they play in the greater ecosystem.
Well, for example, in my series, I talked about this American burying beetle, which is a cool insect that lives in North America. And it's representative of a lot of insects that are in trouble, mainly because, you know, they're not as cute and cuddly and they don't get as much conservation funds. But they're extremely important for keeping our planet healthy and going. And a lot of insects are vital to the health of our soil and thus help keep our environment healthy, because soil is very crucial to agriculture, obviously, which makes our food and goes all the way up the ladder. So a lot of the species that we're losing are the insects, but we might not know about them because they don't get as much media attention, as I said earlier, but they're extremely important.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how scientists and conservationists do decide which species to save? How is it all decided?
Sure. Well, that was the topic of my article, because we were wondering, you know, how does the process actually play out? And what I was surprised to learn was that a lot of it is done in an arbitrary fashion, based on sort of what people like. You know, people like what they want to save. So there are models out there, financial models, that can tell you your return on investment for investing in a species. But for the most part, a lot of governments and organizations will focus on the ones that the public, I guess, enjoys the most. So your tiger, panda, great apes, rhinoceros, and elephant are the main species that conservationist groups focus on.
Is that to say that in some way lay people like me or my neighbor are setting a scientific agenda somehow?
That's a good point. In another article, I explored that issue. Like in China, for example, the panda is such a strong national icon that you could say that the popularity of the animal has influenced the government to put more conservation funds into breeding it in captivity and also protecting it in its natural habitat. So yes, public opinion can really strongly influence conservation funds.
I think about trips to the zoo and some of those endangered species we see in captivity, you know, elephants, rhinoceros, the ones that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there might be some endangered beetles somewhere in there too, you know, in the, the, you know, a lizard in the herpetorium or whatever. But I can't say I've ever gone out of my way to check those things out.
I know. Well, you know, it's part of it is just innate, you know, like we enjoy looking at animals that we can see something of ourselves in. So if we look into a tiger's eyes, we might find a connection. But if we look into a snake's eyes, we might not see anything. So it's not necessarily anything bad. It's just, you know, what human nature connects with on a basic level. So it's not really surprising that we want to save the animals that we can most relate to, that that kind of have forward-facing eyes like us, that are fuzzy. You know, those kind of elements come into play.
Well, you did write about the success of the condor in the American West. And I, when I think about the condor, I don't think it's necessarily cute and cuddly. Why did that species see some success in terms of conservation?
That was actually probably an unusual case in the sense that it had dwindled down to 22 animals. So it was in dire, you know, straits, extremely critically endangered. And I think that conservationists in California just realized how important of a bird it is to the ecosystem and decided to, you know, try to bring it back based on how dire it had gotten. So it's not really an example of you know, cute and cuddly species being saved, but one that had almost literally disappeared from the face of the planet and required, like, emergency assistance.
We're talking with Christine Delamore. She's editor for NationalGeographic.com and its Last of the Last series. She wrote an article called 20,000 Species Are Near Extinction. Is it time to rethink how we decide which to save? We're taking your questions and comments this hour as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about endangered species this hour with Christine Delamore, editor for NationalGeographic.com and its Last of the Last series. She's the author of the recent article, 20,000 Species Are Near Extinction. Is it time to rethink how we decide which to save? And we invite your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Christine, before the break there, we were talking about the American condor and how it, how people banded together to save that species before it went extinct. Can you talk about what exactly went what it took to save that condor?
Sure. Well, what they did was they took the remaining individuals out of the wild, which is a controversial decision in itself. You know, do you intervene into nature in that way? They decided that it was worth it. They took him into breeding facilities and raised chicks in captivity, and then eventually re-released them into the wild, into their native habitat. And it seems to have been successful, and I use it as an example in my story of how conservation can be successful once the decision is made to save a species.
And you had mentioned, too, that it was such a dire situation, that there were just a few condors left in the world, and or at least of the species. And when it comes to other species, though, that might be facing the same circumstances, why aren't we seeing such a scramble all over the place to save those species? Why was the condor so special?
It's hard to say. You know, part of it might be that it's North America, so there might be more funds available for saving the bird, you know, because we might have more conservation support here. But the fact is that there are species that are in dire straits like that nobody's taking care of because there aren't the resources or the funds out there. And that leads to another concept called conservation triage, which is the idea that we should just focus on the animals we can save and then perhaps, you know, let some of the others go by the wayside. And that is an extremely controversial concept. However, it is one that conservationists are beginning to talk about setting criteria for.
And have they established any initial criteria for that?
No. There was one conservationist I talked to who did a poll of 600 conservationists around the world, I think 2 years ago, and they agreed... 54% agreed that we should set some criteria of how to do that, but there isn't a consensus yet, and it's a very sensitive subject, obviously, because how do you go about deciding, you know, which animal will die and which will live? It's extremely difficult, and nobody wants to make that decision.
Do you know of any examples of a species that died because resources were being allocated to something perhaps less crucial to the overall ecosystem?
I actually actually don't. I didn't come across that in my research. However, I imagine that there are, some of the little guys, like I mentioned earlier, like the invertebrates or the insects, mm-hmm. that may have had that experience.
How much does it generally cost to save a species?
Well, it depends what you're looking at. The tiger has millions of dollars spent on it every year. I think there was a statistic in my story that $84 million was spent on it in 2011, I believe. So, that kind of iconic species has massive amounts of funds put into it. Something like the American Burying Beetle, I'm not sure exactly, but I imagine it's, definitely not that high of a number, probably around $1 million or something like that. But it just, again, it goes back to the animals that are popular and the ones that we, have a sort of connection with and what we want to save. That sort of dictates how much funds we put toward them.
Take us into the mind of a conservation scientist for a bit. And you're looking at an entire very lengthy list of species that are on the brink of extinction. Mm-hmm. Why can't I look at that list and say, let's just apply the same approach to all of them?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually being done in some places. Australia, for example, just adopted a new model called the PPP, which is an economic approach to conservation. So actually running the numbers and seeing how many species they can save with the money available, and then actually applying that model as a nationwide strategy. New Zealand had adopted it a few years ago and apparently found it successful. So this is actually one of the other things I explored in my story, is sort of looking at conservation through an economic perspective. And as we can see, if two countries are adopting it, then that's clearly, a possible approach for this dilemma.
And we'll explore that a little bit, too. I did want to talk to you about that New Zealand approach. A listener on Facebook says the first thing to do is change those limited conservation dollars into proper and sufficient dollars. We need to make funding these issues more of a priority and not allow them to continually be chipped away. Mm-hmm. And, Christine, I wanted to ask you, too, to what extent is this perhaps a marketing issue? If a scientist knows that it's absolutely crucial to save the American burying beetle and not as crucial to save that panda, I don't know, I'm just arbitrarily choosing one over the other here. What more could be done then to educate the public as to that need?
Well, changing values is something that a lot of conservationists talk to me about. Actually maybe using conservation dollars to create advertising campaigns or educational programs or just other ways to notify the public about the importance of the species. And one of the examples that someone gave me was the shark fin soup issue, where a lot of sharks are being killed for their fins to put in soups in weddings in Asia. And if we could change these young people's view of sharks as something to eat in their soup, and instead shift that to an important predator in the ecosystem, then that might actually, limit their consumption of the animal. So that's a lot easier said than done, of course, but these are the kind of issues that conservationists are starting to think about, as opposed to just saving the animal, how to change people's values.
And is that a responsibility that weighs heavily on scientists, or is it advocacy groups, or who should take responsibility for that?
That's an interesting question. The whole concept of conservation biology, for example, is a relatively new academic field, and it calls on scientists like biologists to actually take more of a role in trying to conserve the species, rather than just saying, here's the data, you do something with it. They actually take a role in conserving animals. And a lot of it also is advocacy groups such as Conservation International or Nature Conservancy, those kind of big funders.
As we look at some success stories and ongoing efforts to save certain species, how do we know that a species that is being concentrated on is actually being managed properly? That is to say, not creating an inverse problem where there are too many of the species.
I don't know if that's a problem in many places, but I do know that a lot of international, like big groups I just mentioned, will work with local people on the ground, and that's actually another element of my series, is conservationists are trying to work more with local communities and get them invested in their projects, because the thinking goes that if the local communities believe in it and support it, then they'll actually be part of the solution. And in the end, it will help the local people with their, you know, maybe create new farms or help them economically. So a lot of it is having people on the ground kind of monitor real time what's going on and then report back to your office in Washington or what have you.
I see. We are talking with Christine Delamore. She's editor of NationalGeographic.com, and it's Last of the Last series. She's author of the recent article, 20,000 Species Are Near Extinction. Is it time to rethink how we decide which to save? We're taking your questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. You can also reach us on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll take a look at the news, and we'll be back with Christine afterwards. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. It's 6:36 on Monday, January 6th. With 20,000 animal and plant species on the brink of extinction, it's impossible to save them all. So how should scientists decide which species to target for conservation? That's a question we've been tackling this hour with Christine Delamore, editor for NationalGeographic.com and its Last of the Last series. You can join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Christine, before the news, you were talking about how involving local people in conservation can help the overall effort be more successful. How might that kind of cooperation look like?
Well, if you look at, say, the Himalaya, where you have the endangered snow leopard, there are some efforts to sort of compensate farmers who, or herders, I should say, who have lost some of their animals to predation by the snow leopards. So that kind of gives the farmer, or gives the herders, you know, money back for their lost animal, while also perhaps changing their perspective of the snow leopard is not necessarily something to be hated, but just, you know, something that they can live with and live with peacefully.
Does it change their perspective? Do you know?
You know, I interviewed a farmer in, I believe it was Pakistan, and I asked him how he thought about the animal. And yeah, he seemed to have shifted his view and thought, you know, this is an animal that's part of the ecosystem. We realize that we're living in its habitat, and we want to live with it peacefully. And that's the kind of perspective that conservationists are hoping to spread worldwide, sort of living peacefully with the animal and recognizing what needs to be done to do that. You know, there's a lot of problems, for example, in Africa with elephants, for example, that's called a, you know, human-animal conflict. And there's no easy answer, but a lot of it involves just working with communities and figuring out what they need, actually.
What are some of the consequences that one might face by not pursuing a cooperative relationship like that?
Well, you often have, as I mentioned, retaliatory killings. So, you know, if an elephant comes and stampedes, you know, a village, for example, some people might go out and kill the animal instead of, you know, being educated as to what might have happened or how they might have been able to prevent it. So, you know, the poaching and death of animals is basically what the conservationists want to avoid.
We have a call from Rob in Gays Mills. Hi, Rob.
Yeah, hi.
What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I've been working with communities in 14 countries for the last 30 years, and it isn't just a hypothesis. It's a definite fact that solution to protecting animals and forests. when you focus on one species, you save the whole forest. So, for example, in Assam, India, we've worked there, and we have 18 community groups working with the government that are protecting a whole biosphere of about almost 300,000 hectares. And under the flagship of the Golden Langur, we're also saving tigers and elephants. Mm-hmm.
Christine, are you familiar with that, and how is that so? How does one saving one species lead to the overall health and well-being of others?
It's actually, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I haven't had a chance to talk about that concept. Yeah, having a flagship species that's your focus for conservation can often help all of the other species that might not be as well-known. So, for example, the tiger in parts of its range, focusing on that as the animal that the public knows might actually help, you know, like the bush pig or the littler guys that don't normally get conservation attention. So it's kind of a win-win situation. If you're protecting the range of the tiger, you're also protecting the other species that live within it.
Let's take a call next from Richard in Milwaukee. Hi, Richard.
Well, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm well. What's your question or comment?
My comment is, well, it's a quote from Chief Seattle, that we did not make the web of life, but we are all part of it. And I would remind us all that we are, it's all built on the itty-bitty. So everything counts. If mm-hmm. we want to think about all the work that small microorganisms and all the way up, do.
Richard, thanks for that comment. So we're all part of the web of life. That is to say that we're all connected. And Christine, can you talk a little bit about that? If one species goes extinct, for example, then what might that mean for the overall, maybe the food chain or the ecosystem as a whole?
Well, every animal has a role, you know, in its environment. And some have more important roles, like, as I mentioned earlier, the ant. E.O. Wilson is a big advocate of giving attention to ants because they're so crucial to keeping our soil healthy, eliminating pests. So, you know, different species have different ecological values, as you would say. But when you remove one, it does create an impact that, you know, can often create sort of an unsteadiness or a problem that can grow and get worse. It's not exacerbated. So that's why a lot of conservationists focus on reintroduction programs. If there's a way you can put the animal back in the wild, then perhaps you can restore the ecosystem to its previous state.
Is there maybe this goes beyond the purview of your expertise, but if you are rehabilitating an animal species in captivity, how difficult is it to reintroduce them into the wild?
It depends on the species, but it can be extremely difficult. For example, the giant panda, there have only been 3 animals released back into the wild, despite all of these breeding programs all around the world to, you know, create a new population of animals. For the panda, it seems to be just challenging to get the animal to adapt after it's lived in captivity. The first one was actually beaten up by the other males in the territory and died subsequently. So there are things you can't predict in the environment once it's released. You know, talking back to I know I keep mentioning it, but the American burying beetle is being released into various places in North America, and it's also having some trouble restoring the population. So it depends, like, what animal it is, and it's a difficult calculus, just, you know, figuring out how it's going to react to the new environment, whether it's going to thrive.
What's the value, then, of keeping an animal out of the wild, for example, if you're keeping it in captivity?
That's an excellent question. I actually wrote an article about that as well. You know, it was actually about pandas and whether breeding pandas in captivity is really worth it. You know, it's difficult because so many people love this animal and want to see it succeed, but sometimes you have to look at the bottom line and see what is the output, what is actually occurring due to all of this resource allocation. And some people say it takes longer, you need to wait, you know, we're still perfecting the breeding, that kind of thing. If you look at your wolf, for example, though, that is actually a very successful reintroduction program, and there are evidence of reintroduction programs working, and also the condor as well, that I talked about earlier.
Right. Well, is there a point at which scientists might give up on a species, even if they've invested significant time, money, you know, other resources in it?
I have never heard of that actually happening. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that, you know, conservationists are so dedicated to the species that they're working on. I doubt that would happen.
Well, you use the Atlantic salmon as one example in your article of people pouring effort into saving a species. Talk about right. that a bit. How sparse was the Atlantic salmon population before conservation efforts were made?
Well, the conservationist I talked to was focusing on the southern population, I think, in Nova Scotia. And the population had declined to about 200 fish, if I recall. So that's pretty dire, as you would imagine. And they realized that it would require a huge amount of funds to get the fish back into, you know, a point where it would be healthy again. However, they still wanted to do it because Canadians love their salmon and they view it as a very important animal in the country. So they invested a lot of money into, again, bringing the animal into captivity and breeding it there. However, it didn't really work as far as I know. The conservationists I talked to said that the population hasn't really recovered that well.
Well, and one thing you also wrote about, which I'll ask you about after the break, is how economically valuable the Atlantic salmon is to that area. And I'd like to know, you know, if that's a factor in the conservation of other species, too. How important is that to people and to scientists who set the agenda in terms of what to conserve? We're talking with Christine Delamore, editor for NationalGeographic.com, and it's a Last of the Last series. We're taking your calls as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Christine Delamore. She's the editor for NationalGeographic.com and editor of the Last of the Last series at National Geographic. She's the author of 20,000 Species Are Near Extinction. Is it time to rethink how we decide which to save? We are tackling that question this hour and taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Christine, we were talking about the Atlantic salmon. Describe for us the economic impact that saving that species had up in Canada.
Sure. Well, in my story, I mentioned that, you know, salmon is extremely important to Canadians, and it's also important to their economy. In 2010, the fish was worth $255 million in GDP. And that includes numbers that encompass recreational fishing, fishing by the native peoples, tourism, you know, going out to see the fish, education, and spending by various governments and NGOs into, you know, investigating the causes of the fish and its decline.
And it sounds like, you know, obviously the economy had a lot of sway in the decision to focus on that species. How prominent is that in terms of the criteria set for saving other species?
It's becoming more common to look at it in that way. As I mentioned earlier, there's this approach called the PPP, which Australia and New Zealand are looking at. So taking economy into consideration is increasing. However, a lot of people seem to still be wary of that approach. They'd rather sort of look at the ecological value or what does the animal do for the environment. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be a panacea approach. It's kind of a combination of several things.
Looking at New Zealand, what are some of the success stories over there?
You know, I'm not actually sure what the details are. I know that they have a lot of invasive species, which makes their situation more dire. Anytime you have an island You have invasive species like the rats, or they have a small mammal called the stoat that's killing a lot of their native wildlife. I think the walking bat is something that's under threat. So I'm not sure if they have a success stories as of yet. However, they're realizing the severity of the situation with invasive species, and I believe that's why they decided to adopt this economic model to try to get as much bang for their buck as they can.
Mm-hmm. How do we make decisions in cases where conservation seems to conflict with economics? Looking at the spotted owl, for example, in the conservation efforts towards saving the spotted owl, it required logging moratoriums, for example.
Right. Well, it gets back to people's values. You know, what's most important to you, and what are you willing to do for the animal? Going back to the salmon, for example, there are a lot of people in Canada who are willing to spend money to support the conservation of the salmon. I think I quoted a statistic that people would pay $86 a year, $86 US, to support conservation. So a lot of it goes back to your values and what you feel most strongly about supporting, and whether you will open your pocketbook to help the animal as well.
How did they figure out the dollar figure, $86 a year?
I believe they did a survey of 2,800 Canadian households and just asked them how much would you pay, and I believe that's the average amount.
$86.
Yeah.
It's a nice number. Nice random
yeah.
number. Well,
exactly.
We were talking about earlier, we were talking about how habitats and changing habitats are affecting species. How do you manage an entire ecosystem rather than focusing on just one species? How does the approach change?
A lot of it is working with local groups who are already on the ground. So you might have, several tiger conservation groups on the ground in India, for example, and you may make them partners. So by making partners with all of these local groups, you actually have this, very large group of people who are all working toward the same goal. And, instead of being territorial about it, you actually are able to increase your scope and also your influence in the region. So it's collaboration, and it's also knowing what's going on the ground and spending time there and understanding what the issues are and what the local people need to thrive and coexist with the animals in their midst.
Some communities have found ways to turn these conservation efforts into tourist attractions. I'm thinking of safari mm-hmm. parks in Africa, for example. What role does ecotourism play in conservation?
A growing one, for sure. I've heard stories of former hunters or fishermen. I believe there was one story I heard about someone in Mexico who went from killing sea turtles to actually taking people on tours to show them the animal. So that's actually something that a lot of conservationist groups are encouraging local people to do in various areas of the world, and show them that the animal can be worth as much as it is alive as dead. So that's a very common catchphrase that you hear. And a lot of times it actually does work. And, it depends on the area and what the sensibilities are, but it can be a very successful win-win situation for keeping the people, with an income, and also keeping the animal in the ecosystem alive and happy.
I guess I think about the supply and demand that we were talking about a little bit earlier in terms of how to choose what species gets the most attention and resources. And with ecotourism, you might get a safari full of people wanting to go see the elephants and the tigers or the pandas or something, but not the beetles and the frogs and the lizards. Can you describe maybe some of the ecological benefits of those species that people might not have considered?
Sure. Well, actually, when I went to Africa, the first thing I looked for was the dung beetle. So I guess I'm a special case. but animals like that, they are critical to keeping the soil healthy. They rid us of pests, like smaller insects that might eat our crops. They're constantly eating a lot of the dead things that we might not want to see around. I think I heard a statistic that you might see piles of you know, carcasses going up to the sky if you didn't have animals like dung beetles or insects. So they're kind of like behind the scenes helping keep our world humming and healthy, but we just don't really usually see their actions, maybe because they're too small or because they're not cute and cuddly. But without them, we would be in much, much more dire straits.
Are we likely to see more thoughtful approaches to conservation in the future as we become more aware of what's driving our agenda at this point?
I'm not sure. I think conservationists are very aware of the situations. You know, they're aware that we generally save the species that people like. So I think they're trying to use that to their advantage. And, you know, going back to what one of your readers or your viewers talked about with the flagship approach, I think more people are trying to recognize that people will save what they want, but also try to maximize that instinct. So if people want to save the tiger, well, okay, we'll save that area, but what other species can we collect underneath that umbrella that will benefit? So it's working with what we know and what we know people's reactions are. I think that's the best approach.
With 20,000 species at risk of extinction, how many can we really save?
I'm not sure exactly if anyone's looked at, you know, can we save 10,000, can we save 5,000, but there's a push to figure out which realistically we can and which we might have to let go, you know, and it goes back to the concept of conservation triage. I'm not sure that anyone's come up with a hard number, but there are probably at least, you know, hundreds, if not a thousand, that probably could be saved.
Well, we only have just a little bit, maybe about 30 seconds left to go. How can people learn more about some of the endangered species out there and about the conservation efforts surrounding them?
Well, usually, you know, you can start by looking at the big conservation groups' websites. A lot of them have very active campaigns where they try to get people involved. So Conservation International or World Wildlife Fund, Nature Conservancy, a lot of those big ones. National Geographic actually has several initiatives, the Big Cats Initiative to save big cats, an Oceans Initiative. So there's a lot of information on our website as well. And, you know, a lot of these local groups that I mentioned have their own websites too, even, you know, if you're in remote part of Africa, they still have information, and a lot of people are very active from North America or other places on the ground trying to help through volunteering, you know, tourism programs that allow you to actually get out in the field and help yourself. That's a growing concept as well.
Christine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was Christine Delamore, editor for NationalGeographic.com. This is the Ideas Network.